Good morning. Turn to Esther chapter number 4. Last week, Brother Tim finished chapter 3 and he got just a little bit into chapter 4 as planned. And we're going to go back over those three verses in chapter 4. But we're going to just do the entire chapter for this morning. If you, let me just make this plug. If you ever miss a Sunday or Wednesday, all our messages are recorded and you can listen to them on the Sermon Audio app. And you can hear Job from Wednesday nights or any message from the Kings and the Prophets. It's all sorted by series. It's a great tool. I use it when I travel and able to stay caught up. And you can share them through that app if you want to share the lessons with someone or messages with someone. It's a great tool. And if you need help using that, there's plenty of us that can help you find those. But yeah, so Brother Tim last week went through Esther chapter 3, and then he dabbled just a couple verses into chapter 4. So let's just start reading. I'm going to dissect chapter 4 as we go. And at the end of the day today, we'll finish chapter 4 and be ready for chapter 5. By the end of chapter 4, again, and I've said this often, if you're keeping score, you're kind of like, I don't know what's about to happen. I mean, I'm so glad we have the Word of God that's complete and is not revealed to us portion at a time. You know, we can read the whole book of Esther and understand where it's going, what happens and all that. But if you were just reading this and exposed to this story in a weekly setting like this, it'd leave you kind of hanging at the edge of your seat at the end of chapter 4 today. But let's start reading Esther chapter 4. We're going to read the first three verses and then we'll get started. It says, when Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and a bitter cry and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And every province, whether so the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. And I tell you, we are at a cultural disadvantage when it comes to understanding exactly what this is like. And if we just see not only the visual scene of someone tearing their clothes and donning this sackcloth and ashes, but the hearing of the wailing, it would make our culture uncomfortable. I'm telling you, it would be loud. It would be heart-wrenching. And we don't quite understand, I believe, what this sounds like, what this looks like, but it's a phenomenal scene just in these three verses. And he is grieved. He is cut to the heart with the edict or the conclusion of what's going to happen in chapter 3, the plot of what came up manifested in chapter 3. He is absolutely grieved, and it was deep. And not only did he concern for his life as a Jew, but he, and Tim said it correctly last week, he understands that the Messiah is coming from the Jewish people. And if you annihilate the Jewish people, then this hope that's coming will not manifest itself. And he understands the results of all this. And he is just completely grieved with the tremendous danger on his own life, the tremendous danger with his people, but the coming of the Messiah. So these emotions that he has are great right now. And let me say, there is no indication in the text that he felt sorry for his actions to refuse to bow down. You know, there's no indication that he's not repenting that. And that tells me that was a conviction that was based on his beliefs on why he didn't bow. Because he's not wailing and mourning because of that. And another thing, funny enough, I wish, but this isn't true, I wish he was wailing and mourning because he knows what God's going to do to Haman if you threaten God's people. I wish that's what it was. That's not the way. He is personally digesting this and comprehending this for himself and his people. And it is great tragedy in him. And again, in chapter 3, verse number 4, he did say, I am a Jew. And the reason all this is happening is because of that statement in chapter 3, verse 4. When he said that he was a Jew, if he hadn't have not bowed down, if he hadn't refused to do that, if he hadn't revealed who he was in that one single comment, none of this would happen. But let's talk about sackcloth and ashes briefly, because we hear it a lot, but I want you to understand exactly what it is, because it is very significant as well. It pictures humility, obviously, this low estate of a person who's entering into this activity. And again, they're mourning the evil that is about to play out against them. And he does four things here in these three verses. He does four things. His actions are, number one, he tears his clothes. Number two, he puts on sackcloth, which again is traditional mourning apparel. And we'll talk about not mourning as in the day, but mourning as in emotional grief and sorrow. So he puts on sackcloth, he puts ashes on himself, and then he laments loudly. Those four things, all common in the ancient world in the East. And all of these actions of what Mordecai is doing is indicating, again, he is very upset with the evil, that's been plotted against him and his people. He did not treat evil lightly. He did not just brush this off. He is personally expressing grief, and he's making himself, I want you to understand, this is key to when you read in the Word of God about sackcloth and ashes, he is making himself uncomfortable with the situation at hand. So that's what mourning is. Mourning is an expression of grief. Mourning is when you're going through a loss, it's a necessary process. I've said many times, there's no rules on how to mourn or how long to mourn, especially in our culture when it comes with a loss. Everyone mourns different for different lengths of time, for different periods. In this culture, again, it was making themselves uncomfortable. And you cannot be, again, mourning, you will never be able to heal or to cope, if you will, or to recover if mourning does not occur. So this process has to happen. Now, sackcloth, let's just break that down. Sackcloth is a very coarse, almost what we would think would be burlap type material. Strangely enough, it was most often made from the hair of black goats. So the garment that they put on is very, very rough, and it's black. Now, in our culture, we've adopted that color somewhat in our mourning. We understand that we wear black, and their sackcloth was black. It was very uncomfortable, very itchy, very scratchy, as mourning should not be something joyful. It is a melancholy experience. So it's very loose, it's black, and it signifies this period of expression of remorse or repentance or grace. And the discomfort in the clothing served as a physical manifestation of the discomfort or loss. That's what it is. It's all done on purpose. Now, ash, I think we understand, would accompany this garment in times, because sometimes you could just have sackcloth. But if there's a time where you're mourning destruction or something that's a national tragedy, if you will, they would apply ash to their heads. And when you look at ash, that's symbolic of something that's been totally ruined or something that's been destruction. Ash is the result of fire and destroying something, right? I mean, there's very little, and I know there are some, with even in our culture, we use ash in different processes, but there's very little positive things that come from ash. Ash symbolizes destruction. So wearing this itchy, black, loose, uncomfortable garment and piling this ash on yourself completely is a physical outward expression of what's happening internally. There are very few of those that we can participate, but there are some where we have an outward expression of an inward situation. And this is one of them that he's going through. Now, I find this very interesting. There's nothing, according to verse 3 here, there is nothing but pleasant appearances that enter the court. And everything that was melancholy is banished. You can't have, because it says, and in every province, this happened. I'm sorry, in verse number 2, and it came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. Now, fascinating enough, keep your place there. Go to Matthew chapter 11. Jesus comments on this very thing. Not this exact situation, but this idea of what was said in Esther. In Matthew chapter 11, John the Baptist is in this prison state, questioning to himself and to his followers who Jesus Christ really is after everything he's experienced. And if you look at verse number 8, it says, here's Jesus Christ speaking, "But what went ye out to see? A man clothed in soft raiment?" Then he says this, "Behold, they that wear soft clothing are in king's houses." You know what that means? If you wear coarse clothing, you're not allowed in. That's what Jesus Christ is saying. And that's what it says in Esther chapter 4, verse 2. "None might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth." Why? Well, that brings us to stupid rule number 1 found in chapter 4. Stupid rule number 1 says that no one can be sad in the presence of the king. Now let's think about that. If you're the king, wouldn't you want to know what's going on with your people? You would think you do. But they have a rule in their society that you can't, in the presence of the king, inside the court or anywhere around where the king might be, you can't act like this. You have to have soft raiment. You have to be upbeat. You have to be having a positive general appearance. And this will come into play later on in the chapter. But this is a very important sentence at the end of chapter 4, verse 2, about the fact that you can't be inside the king's gate. So this place of mourning proved is very significant. The king's gate was a place of honor. The king's gate was a place of distinction. The sackcloth and ashes, they are not accepted. They are not a way, they are not the appropriate way to approach the king's house. You're out of bounds with their culture and their society if you breach the gate with sackcloth on and ashes on your head. Keep that away from the king. That's what we're seeing right here. And the response to Mordecai is not just this personal issue with death. Again, he's not done. He is realizing again the importance of everything that's about to happen, and he knows this stupid rule. Trust me, and it'll play out. He knows this rule that you're not supposed to enter the king's gate in this attire, in a state of mourning. If you are mourning, the king doesn't want to know about it. If you're sad, keep it away. If you're mourning, keep it away. If there was sickness that caused death, keep it away. The king protects himself from that. And so that's where we're at right here. Let's go to verse number 4 now and just read a couple of verses 4 and 5. So Esther's maids, this is a big deal. There's a man out there with sackcloth and ashes at the king's gate. I want you to understand that. That's what we just read. So Esther's maids and the chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved, because she knows stupid rule number 1. This is not good. She knows that. And she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai and to take away his sackcloth from him. But he received it not. She here is not responding to the situation that's causing him to mourn. She's giving him raiment. Not only this raiment, indicates that she is not only sending him the appropriate apparel for where he's at, but also oils, and to make him smell better and to make him look better. Know where you're at, Mordecai. And trust me, if you said that to him, he would say, "I know exactly where I'm at, Esther." And she doesn't quite understand yet. Okay, so she's saying, "Have some discernment." And he's saying, "No, have some discernment." That's what's going on right here. And so verse number 4, so she sends him that. But he received it not. Then called Esther for Hatach, one of the king's chamberlains,
whom he had appointed to attend upon her, and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. She's saying, listen, he will not, he's stubborn. He's a stubborn old Jewish man. He's breaching the gate, wearing the inappropriate apparel. He's obviously got something going on. He's refused my raiment. Please, and so she sends this eunuch, please go and find out what is going on. That's the first exchange that we just read here. And her response, again, she calls Hatach, one of the servants. She requires his assistance. She can't go herself, and we'll talk about that here in a second. But she can't go herself because she's the wife of a queen. She could not be found in that situation. She does exercise discernment here. She knows her limits. She just doesn't know the cause of why this is going on. So let's continue reading. Verse number 6. So Hatach went forth to Mordecai unto the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. I mean, he's violating this. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay for the Jews' treasuries, to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Also, he gave him a copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther and to declare it unto her and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make request before him for her people. And Hatach came and he told Esther the words of Mordecai. Again, Esther spake unto Hatach and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whatsoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of this to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. So let's break this down. So this is exchange number 2. So she sends Hatach to find out what's going on. He then talks to Mordecai. So she sends him out. She's like, what's troubling him? Why is he refusing this raiment? Why is his behavior not appropriate to the situation that he's in? And Mordecai then informs Hatach and he tells Haman's plot. He is so detailed with this that he provides a copy of the decree and the edict to her, because it says that he has the decree that was given at Shushan. It was what verse number 8 says. So he has provided a copy. He sends a copy of the edict to Esther through this eunuch, and desired for her to see it for herself. And he presses Esther. Mordecai presses Esther. Go to the king to make supplication unto him and make a request for the people. Her response, though, when she is told all this, she's going to say, all right, we need to have another back and forth. You need to now go tell him. You need to now go tell Mordecai. There's this standing law. And this is stupid law number 2. There's this standing law that no one can approach the king without being summoned. They will be put to death. So let's break down stupid law number 2. So here's what stupid law number 2 is. And this is extremely real. In fact, it even says in verse number 11 that everyone knows about this law. Even Mordecai knows about this law. It says that all the servants and all the people and all the king's province, they know about stupid law number 2, that you cannot just go in unto the king. Well, why do they have this law? It's really, this law was made not so much for the safety of the king. You know, it wasn't the king's secret service that said, we need to do background checks and we need to clear people who come into your presence. It wasn't that. It was a prideful law. And what the law implied was, if no one can come in to see the king, then the king is very mysterious. And the king kind of takes this little g god aura about him, because no one can just approach him. No one can see him.
You know, there's so much. If there was preaching going on here, there's so much about the access to the king and all that stuff that we could talk about. But this is teaching, so you save that for another guy. But there's so much about that that's going on in this situation. I mean, this is layers and layers and layers of symbolism here. I want you to understand that. Don't miss out on that just because I'm not covering it. But the king is not accessible. The king is not accessible. And it gives him this mysterious aura about him. Now, there were some downfalls recorded in history. There's some downfall to that. Number one, the kings, they weren't really happy with that. Number one, they didn't really like killing everyone that they saw. And number two, it made them very, very lonely. In fact, you hear a lot in Disney cartoons about the princess who says, "I'm a prisoner in my own palace." Nah, no, you're not. You're a cartoon character. These kings actually felt like prisoners in their own palace. They could not interact with anyone. So first of all, they would never see unhappiness. And second of all, they'd never see anyone because no one approached them. So they had no idea what was really going on. Do you think they're surrounding themselves with people telling them the truth? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. They had no idea what the real pulse of the empire was. And so the kings were very, very lonely. And again, not only that, but not only is it bad for the king, but it's bad for the subjects. We read about good kings like Solomon. What's he doing? Well, he's taken a judgment that was wrong, and it was made its way up to the Supreme Court, to the king, and then he could take that wrong judgment and make it right. See, they didn't have stupid law number two. They had access to the king. Oh, there's layers there. I want you to understand that. But the subjects, you want to be able to present a problem to the king and have the king make righteous judgment over that. That didn't exist in this society, in this culture. They couldn't approach the king like that. And funny enough, third thing is, there's no provision made for wives. My wife is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. We have access full time 24/7. There is not that in this culture. There's no provision. She hasn't even seen her husband for 30 days. Is what she says. She can't go do that. Now, there's one or two reasons why that is. Again, just because, as we've read in the first three chapters, there's a lot of laws in this kingdom that he's just like, I can't change it. I said it, so I have to go with it. It's a very weird power structure that goes on here. But number two, it also kind of protects the king to play around with other concubines and different things because she can't just barge in anytime she wants. So there's a whole lot of weird things going on with stupid law number two. Regardless, Mordecai knows it, she knows it, and he says, you need to go do it. That's exchange number two between her and Mordecai. Let me just say this. Miserable is the kingdom where the laws are framed to serve lusts. If you set up all these laws and it's to shield you so you can participate in lust, it's miserable. Your house is miserable. Your kingdom is miserable. He's miserable. He is miserable. I don't feel sorry for him, but I'm telling you, he's miserable because of stupid law number one and stupid law number two. But she knows it, so she's just saying, hey, I can't do it. Let's read verse number 12. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house, shall escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest the peace at this time, then shall there an enlargement and a deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to this kingdom for such a time as this? So here's what he's saying. He is exercising tremendous faith. Let me tell you this. I hope you understand this. This is free. You can use it in your house. You can use it in your work. You can use it in your ministry. Attitudes are contagious. Attitudes are contagious. You show up on Monday and you're hating everything, your crew hates everything. You show up on Monday excited, get to work, let's do it, your crew's excited to get to work. Same thing with family vacations. Same thing with ministries. Attitudes are contagious.
And Mordecai, he's saying, listen, sweetie, you need to have some faith. God is going to rescue his people, whether we're a part of it or not. But don't think that you're protected because you're in the king's house. That's what he's saying. You need to do something about it. And he's got faith. He's got understanding. He was raised right and understands the promises of God. He knows that, yes, he's grieved. And yes, he understands all these things. Yes, he understands the implications. He's a very complex man, as Tim said last week. But he knows God's going to accomplish something if you're a part of it or not. But you have an opportunity to exercise faith and to position yourself in the right place. So the first part, he says, is to remind Esther that she is not excluded. The next part, again, he's showing her faith. He tells Esther there will be deliverance from somewhere. You want to be a part of it because you have been put in this position for a reason. Then this statement is made, and who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And he's saying, listen, you need to take advantage of the opportunity that's given to you. You're in this place. You need to have faith. You're right there. Go do it. It's a very, if we had time, we could really accept this text as this charge of faith that you are in the right position at the right time. And guess what? So are you all day tomorrow. You're in the right position at the right time if you're doing the right thing. And he is just firing her up, in my opinion. And he's saying, you need to take advantage of this. Don't forget who you are. Do the right thing. And we'll talk about all that in a second. And at this point, Esther, she begins, I believe, to see the influence of a greater power at work, which is the Lord. I think that she's being pressed upon. Now, God's not mentioned in this text or in this book, and we understand that. But his providential hand, his seeing to it, as we've taught, his seeing to it is very evident. Mordecai had to remind her of where she's at. And again, God is not mentioned, but something here makes her respond the way she does. And he knows her enough. He raised Esther. He knows her enough to prompt her into action. And he's encouraged and he's saying, listen, you've got to do something. You're the only hope in this situation because of the position you're in. Again, another situation could come up. I'm trusting the Lord in this, but I'm telling you what, that other situation might not include you in your house. That's what he says. Verse 15. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. So we go back to the final exchange. Go. I love this. Let me just up until this point, Mordecai is like, do this, do this, do this. And this is the perfect example that attitudes are contagious. Because now she takes control. Like, look at the words here in this exchange. The first exchange, she's like, here's some clothes, make yourself right. He's like, no. And then she's like, here, tell us what's wrong. And he says, give it to this. And she's receiving all this stuff. Now, she steps up. I mean, it's exciting stuff. Wish there was like a movie or something. Okay. Go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me. And neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. That's big stuff.
Yes, sir.
That is a complete turn. Now, I love youth conferences that are titled for such a time as this. But if I perish, I perish is way more impactful to me. This is not this fatalistic, if I die, I know. This is, I know the duty that's given to me by God. And I'm going to do the right thing regardless of the consequences. Do you understand what the definition of courage is? Courage is doing the right thing when you don't know the outcome. That's not bravery. That's not wisdom. That's not strength. It's courage. When you stand up at work and you don't know the outcome and you do the right thing. I stand for this. I'm not going to participate in this because of this reason. I don't know if I'm going to keep my job or lose my job or be made fun of. I don't know. But I'm going to have courage. I'm going to have courage. Oh, courage is hard.
You don't know the outcome, but you have faith. And she doesn't know the outcome at this moment. And she's not saying, well, if I die, I die. That is not what she's saying. She's saying, I'm going to do the right thing. She says, we're going to do it in 3 days from now. We're going to fast. We're going to pray. I need your help to fast and pray. Because one voice is good, that's sufficient. But multiple voices, fasting and praying. And because, see, she knows the stories of her people. She knows them. And she says, for 3 days, we're going to commit to do this. And then I'm going to do the most courageous thing that I've done. I don't understand why I was sex trafficked and put into this position. And now I have a husband who I haven't seen in 30 days. I don't understand. But I see that God put me here for a reason now. And regardless of the outcome, I'm going to do the right thing. I mean, that is amazing. I hope we can all stand at the end of our lives and say, I had that same attitude. I haven't every single time, but I try. I mean, this is the most courageous thing. Listen, this is not, okay, I'm in this line. I normally do self-check. I'm going to give that person a track and I don't know the outcome. This is not that. But if that's the most courageous thing you did, good.
Amen.
I mean, good. But this is not that. Okay? This is life or death. Everyone knows stupid law number two. Everyone knows that what she's going to tell him is going to be sad and violate stupid law number one. She's going to violate both stupid laws in 3 days. And she says, if I perish, I perish. I love it. Prepare the fast. It is extremely, supremely dangerous what she's going to do. And it's very risky. But she's prepared to do it. You know, there's a lot of old time writers that say, they compare this right here. They say it like this, and I'll never say it this pretty. And it's really wordy if I read how they write it, so I'll try to explain it. But they say that the Jewish people in this situation is God's Isaac on the altar. You understand what I'm saying? That God presents his children as a whole on the altar right there. And when Abraham did that to his son, he knew that God would provide a way. Didn't understand how, but he knew that God could raise him from the dead if he took him. That is completely clear in Scripture. That no matter what Abraham knew, he did know that God could raise him from the dead. He just didn't know how far he'd have to go. God is laying his Isaac on the altar, his children. That's what some people say. It's pretty. It's beautiful. I think there's some accuracy here to that kind of thinking. But here's the deal. They're just trusting in the providential hand of God here. God is going to see to it. I mean, you know, we're at the end of chapter 4. We know that she's courageous. Now, let's say that we haven't read chapter 5 yet. You know, that's next week. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, this is a very interesting part right here that we're just going to stop at. But let me tell you this. You should serve God not because we are assured of earthly success. There is no guarantee that we'll have 57 more years here. We are not assured of 7 years here. We're not assured as a church to have 7 months here, 7 weeks here, or 7 hours here. But that should not keep us or keep you individually from serving God. Just because you don't know the outcome. It's our duty to serve God. If we're here on earth, we are. It is God's desire, which is why we're here. To serve Him. And we are to do our God-given duty regardless of the results. If a missionary goes someplace, if they're called to that place, regardless of their timetable and their PowerPoint, they're called to that place regardless of the results. And we are called here. Regardless of what is going to happen, this is our duty right here. We're doing it. We have to do the right thing. We do not need promises of success to guide our service. That, if that is what you're waiting, the sign I need is a promise of success. That's the wrong sign. I don't know where you're getting your wisdom from. Our success is guided by precepts. And there's the Word of God. And there are a lot of precepts that include promises with them. But that doesn't mean it's a promise of success. So we just have to just be careful with that. And promises are wonderful. Yes, promises are wonderful. And often many promises do come with precepts. But whether they are in abundance or not, it does not affect what our duty is. It does not affect it. The promises are great. Esther accomplished what we're going to find next week. She accomplished a great work for God in delivering the Jews from destruction because she came to the point where she totally committed herself to her duty. She totally committed herself. Now, I want you to understand this, and then I'm done. Lack of commitment will kill accomplishments for God in every attempt. I mean, you have to be committed. If you're like, I wonder why my soul winning is not what it is. I wonder why my spiritual life is not what it is. What's your commitment? What's your commitment? If you have a lack of commitment, it's going to kill it. It's going to kill it. She was committed. She said, pray for me. Pray for the situation. Fast for me. Fast for the situation. 3 days from now, I'm going to go do it. I mean, that's commitment. It's an amazing story. And again, there are so many layers in chapter 4 that we're not going to cover in a Sunday school. But I hope you understand. She had courage. If anything, yes. Yes, for such a time as this. It's a great verse. I'm not bashing it. It's a great banner. It's a great motto. It's a great theme because it's real. But that attitude of if I perish, I perish. That's grit. That's commitment. That's doing the right thing. That to me... That's everything in this chapter. I mean, she was courageous. All right, let's get ready for Big People Church.